Welcome to Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, a podcast for students by students, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Measuring Success Right. Today on the podcast, we have Genevieve Cole and Harriet Huang. Both Genevieve and Harriet are published with the Ballard Brief, and we look forward to discussing their research about violence against refugee women in the MENA region. But first, let me tell you a little bit about both authors. Genevieve is a junior studying interdisciplinary humanities with minors in both international development and Arabic. She earned a Ballard Scholar for Social Impact Award in 2022. She is interested in pursuing a career in the sphere of international development, assisting in refugee relief efforts. Genevieve grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and is a big fan of the East Coast. Harriet is from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and is a senior studying geography, global studies, and minoring in global women's studies. She is passionate about women's rights and learning from women around the world. We are so excited to have these women on the podcast today. So let's dive right into it. So first, how did you both become aware of the violence happening in the MENA region?
So I became aware of concepts regarding the refugee crisis in the Middle East in general when I was in high school. I remember learning about the Syrian refugee crisis and was just super intrigued by what refugees were, what they were facing, and what I could do to help. But as a teenager, I just felt really underprepared for that world. Once I got to college, I started studying Arabic and international development, and I became more acutely aware of the specific kinds of violence that women face.
Yeah, so when I was a senior in high school, there was a local organization, and I just volunteered once a week with refugee women from, refugee Rohingya women. And there was one woman in particular that I helped, every week. And I just remember talking to her, and she had two kids that were also in the U.S. with her. And just hearing her experiences and how difficult it was to be in a new culture with a different language, alone with no family or friends, and also just being forced to leave her home just really struck a chord with me. And I've always been really interested in women's issues, and Jenny and I actually met in the Do Good Better class, and we took it during COVID, so it was over Zoom. And fun story, we had a breakout room with just us two, and we both realized that we wanted to do issue briefs on something regarding women's issues, particularly with refugees. And so I messaged her over Zoom, and then we just we picked this topic together, and it's been really cool to really dive deep into it.
You guys are super cool. I guess for listeners who may not be super aware, maybe don't know, what exactly is the MENA region?
Yeah, so the MENA region is the Middle East and North Africa region. And so the Middle East consists of the countries you'd think of, like Syria, Iraq, Iran, Jordan, Israel, Lebanon. And then North Africa is from Morocco to Egypt, to Tunisia, Algeria, Libya. And then we also include a lot from Sudan and Somalia in our brief.
I mean, I didn't know that, so I already learned something new. Where are these refugees in the MENA region coming from, and why are they displaced?
So at this time, as far as we know, the highest number of refugees are coming from Syria, and this is as part of resulting from the Syrian civil war that started in 2011. So most of our research comes from Syrian refugee populations. And a variety of conflicts have occurred in the MENA region over the past two decades. Like we mentioned, the Syrian civil war, as well as the Arab Spring, has led to an influx of refugees and forced displacement. And as well as environmental circumstances in the Middle East, water scarcity is a huge problem, and this has forced certain societies to have to move.
I feel like it's really crazy that there's all these things going on and we maybe aren't even aware of it. So I love that there's briefs out that we can learn these things from. Just to get an idea of scale, how many refugee women or generally refugees are found in the MENA region?
So in the MENA region, there's about 9 million refugees, and about 50% of those are female, which is higher than average around the world for females. And then to put this in context, there's about 27 million refugees worldwide. So that puts about a third in the MENA region. And another thing that I think is important to know also is that a lot of these refugees have been in refugee camps for years. If you think about just like the Syrian war, a lot of the displacement has been going on for decades. And so these stats also come from the United Nations Refugee Agency. But yeah, those are the current numbers.
Okay, so when you say violence against women, what kinds of violence are we referring to? And also about how many refugee women are impacted by this violence?
So unfortunately, there is a large and expansive variety of different kinds of violence that refugee women are exposed to. And this violence may occur as they're fleeing their homes along migration paths and within refugee camps. And that's kind of the different areas we studied in our brief. So the three main kinds are physical, mental, / emotional or psychological, as well as sexual. And so when we're referring to physical violence in our brief, this is often referring to physical assault from a perpetrator. This might look like slapping, hitting, shoving, kicking, dragging, as well as human trafficking. And when we refer to mental, otherwise known as emotional or psychological violence, this can be mental abuse, humiliation, as well as simply threats of violence or coercion and manipulation. And then sexual violence, this includes instances of rape, abuse, sexual exploitation, forced prostitution, and sexual harassment. And the other thing to note is with this violence, a lot of it's rooted in gender-based violence, as well as intimate partner violence, referring to violence from a current or past partner. And then to answer your question about how many refugee women are impacted by this violence, as of 2019, 20% of all internally displaced or refugee women have experienced sexual violence or a different form of violence. And typically, as individuals and families become refugees, they are expected to experience an increase in violence. This is why oftentimes we say women are kind of the worst victims of conflict or war, because this is an increase in violence from what they may have already been experiencing. And so as we said, 20% of all internally displaced refugee women have experienced sexual violence, but within the MENA region, female refugees often experience violence to an even higher degree. In 2010, the World Health Organization, or WHO, conducted a survey of 80 countries, and it showed that 30% of women reported physical or sexual abuse, but that number rose to 37% in the Middle East region.
37% is super high. That makes me really sad for those women. I guess to just further understand the issue a little bit more, in the case of gender-based violence, who are generally the perpetrators?
So overall, the most reported perpetrator is an intimate partner. So that is often a husband or a boyfriend. But there are many reported cases of perpetrators being human traffickers, military personnel, humanitarian agency staffs, police officers, and guards. So a lot of, again, like I was saying, overall, it's intimate partners. But often, women experience gender-based violence on their route to a refugee camp. And we'll talk about this a little more. But it's really dangerous for women to travel, especially if they're on their own or things like that. And so they're very vulnerable during their whole trip to, who I was saying, like the military personnel, police officers, and such. And so there's a lot of different perpetrators, but again, we'll be seeing in what we're talking about in like later on, that intimate partners, that is really where the main perpetrators come from.
Sort of connected, why is the violence against women so rampant among refugee populations?
There is a variety of ways that we can answer this, but we're just going to go over some of the reasons that we studied for why refugee women may experience violence to a higher degree than the general female world population. And the first reason I want to talk about is a reason we may not always think about, Which is that many refugee women give consent to sexual and gender-based violence because their perpetrators offer services or resources that women would not otherwise be able to acquire due to a lack of economic resources. So when you think about refugees, they aren't normally given like a warning that they're going to be forcibly displaced. And so they're leaving with basically nothing, usually just themselves and their family, and very limited money. And so a really common occurrence, but unfortunate one, is one known as transactional sex. And so this is when individuals who are providing essential transportation will sexually abuse women because these women do not have economic funds to provide for their transportation. Women have also been known to agreeably enter human and sexual trafficking as a means of transport. And along with this as well, unfortunately, in places of enforcement or migration control, women have faced sexual extortion from guards and law enforcement in order to fulfill economic or travel needs. And then as you move within refugee camps and communities themselves, women may face a continued lack of economic resources, and so they will again engage in consenting to sexual extortion or exploitation in order to attain resources such as food or other necessary means of survival from refugee camp staff.
Also, a huge problem is with reporting policies. There's a huge disconnect between the actual needs of refugee women in camps versus the policies implemented to protect them. And so there's a lack of effectiveness around policies against the perpetrators, and women often find themselves in very vulnerable situations. A lot of women who aren't registered through the United Nations Refugee Agency, which there are many reasons that they might not be registered, but if you're not registered, they lack a lot of the basic protections if they were to like come out against their perpetrator. And there's no effective policies also holding like humanitarian workers accountable. And it's also, there hasn't been any emphasis on actually implementing policies that may be in place. And so they're in such a vulnerable situation because there's only so much they can do, but there's a lot of prejudice against victims of gender-based violence. And so if they were to come forward, they might suffer repercussions from speaking out.
And then the last kind of reason that we focused on in our research has to do with inadequate structural protection inside and outside refugee camps. So we've talked about the economic needs as well as the lack of policy, but then within just the physical structural design of camps and outside camps themselves, women can find themselves in high-risk spaces for violence. So for example, most refugee camps are very overcrowded, and so refugee women will share shelters with other families or individual strangers that they're not related to. And these spaces do not provide adequate privacy or means of protection. And then mostly regarding washing and toilet facilities, they're often far away from where women may be encamping and typically not well lit. And so women will avoid going to these facilities because they're high-risk spaces for violence or abuse or harassment. And also these washing and toilet facilities are not separated based on gender. And so it just leads to very high-risk spaces for violence that women try to avoid. And then outside of these refugee camps, as refugee women migrate between countries, they can be exposed to violence from police, migration workers, border control, as well as trafficking and smuggling groups. There's actually regions within the Middle East, North Africa region that are unpoliced and just free from any sense of legal protection. And in these kinds of regions and spaces, smuggling and trafficking rings flourish.
I think another thing to note is also in these situations, these women are in places that they're unfamiliar with. And like you think of like for us, like even in the US, it's really, I just think it's a huge problem where like sexual assault is underreported. And we can think of like the social stigma in the, just even like in our own culture around that. And you can think of a lot of reasons why a woman might be afraid to come out. A lot of like people aren't properly educated on what resources they have, even if they're at a university that has like Title IX. Still, a lot of women aren't familiar with their rights and their protections. And so, if you can imagine for these women who are not in their own home, who are very unfamiliar with like what their legal rights are, it's really hard for them to come forward and know that they're protected, because a lot of times they're not protected if they come forward. So I think that's a huge part in understanding like why these women wouldn't come out. Yeah.
Now that we have a better understanding of what violence is happening, what consequences does this violence have on refugee women?
So a main consequence is social stigma, and this will kind of go into another consequence of mental health. But a lot of the cultural standards prominent in the MENA region cause victims of gender-based violence to face various forms of social stigmatization. This can look like social isolation, outcastment, even loss of like political and economical standing in their communities. It can also lead to discrimination, exclusion, and inequality in the home or the workplace. And there's a lot of strong feelings of shame that is commonly found in these cultures surrounding like loss of female virginity before marriage or outside of marriage, but also in the case where the perpetrator is an intimate partner, that can also follow a lot of shame just within like a family. And another part of this is that the shame can follow the whole family, not just the victim. And so they can feel a lot of pressure to not come forward, because they don't want to bring that type of shame to their family. And so for a lot of victims, it's hard for them to come forward and bring more attention to their situation because of so much of like the social stigma around it.
Another big consequence of violence against refugee women has to relate to physical health. This can look like chronic pain from joint disorders or facial and back pain, as well as cardiovascular problems, gastrointestinal disorders such as abdominal pain or digestive problems, and neurological problems such as severe headaches, vision and hearing problems, memory loss, or traumatic brain injury. And these, of course, would be related often mostly to physical and sexual assault. Gender-based and sexual-based violence often also leads to sexual reproductive health concerns such as unwanted pregnancies, unsafe abortions, miscarriages, sexually transmitted diseases and infections, as well as complications with fertility. And specifically, forced sex itself can result in vaginal tearing, pelvic pain, increased pain associated with menstruation, and instances of sexual assault with younger women can likely lead to complications tied to early childbearing ages, including such as death.
Going along with the consequences of social stigma and physical health is their mental health. Victims are at a much greater risk of depression, anxiety, eating disorders, and PTSD. And again, with like the social stigma, they have strong feelings of shame, isolation, shock, and guilt. And these consequences of mental health can affect their ability and their willingness as victims to report. Also, very few women have access to proper clinical help to aid them with like their struggles with physical and mental health as well.
Really quickly, we just wanted to include a small disclaimer for the research that we've talked about today. It's important to recognize the difficulty of collecting data when it comes to violence against refugee women in the Middle East, North Africa region due to fear, insecurity, lack of justice protection, and insufficient reporting mechanisms. So this leads to massive underreporting and creates some barriers to collecting information. Everything we've talked about today is just kind of scratching the surface for what is out there and what information we have. But we're excited to keep moving forward.
This topic is definitely a hard and heavy one, but there are people like you and other organizations that are trying to raise awareness and do very active things to fight against it. So what specifically is being done to combat the violence against the woman in the MENA region? Is there anything that we can do?
Because this is such a large and complicated and multifaceted problem, there is a lot of work being done to assist refugee women in efforts to protect them or help them heal from violence. But there's also just a variety of different programs out there focusing on different facets of this problem. So, for example, some programs may focus on providing medical aid for victims of violence or resources for mental health. Others may focus on educating women on their legal rights and how to seek legal reparations. Still, other programs focus on financial empowerment, since women who engage in greater financial empowerment opportunities have a reported decreased probability in experiencing intimate partner violence.
Yeah, so a specific organization that's a really good example of this is called Support to Life. And it's a really cool project because what they do is they're based in Turkey, but one of their projects was for refugee women from Syria. And all of their volunteers through the program were also Syrian women themselves, which I think was really cool because they were able to come to these women from a place of understanding of their culture, of their situation. And the project was that the volunteers, they would help train and teach about like the legal system and kind of educate these women on their rights, and as well like how to contact public services, where they can go for help and things like that. And it was a project to really empower these women, to kind of help them know that, first of all, like they deserve to get help. I think it's really cool, again, that they had that community of women together who understood each other and were really there to help one another. But I think a huge part about this is, like for us, it can kind of feel like, oh, this is just like a different world, really far away from us. How can we help? But there's a lot of like local refugee organizations, even just in Salt Lake City. And I also think a huge part of it is also just like being open and willing to learn about these situations. And I think a big part is also recognizing like differences in cultures that can kind of sometimes prevent us from fully understanding the situation. That was a big part for us writing this valor brief, is just learning about, it's like one thing for us to come into it with a much more like American, like Western viewpoint, seeing this conflict. But I think if we really want to help people in these types of situations, we have to come from a sense of like, there's a lot for us to learn from these people. And I think that can better help.
That was awesome. I think it is really cool to hear about the different things that are being done and then just knowing what we can do as individuals, maybe that aren't as close to the situation. So based off of your guys' research, but then also your life experience, how would you guys measure success?
For me, I often get so overwhelmed with questions like these. I study international development and humanities, and there's just so much injustice and wrong in the world, and I'm just one person. And so then I wonder, like, what can I even do? Like, how can I even begin to be a drop in the ocean of trying to make a difference when it just often feels impossible? This past semester, I was actually doing a study abroad over in Jordan and Israel. And while I was in Israel specifically, and learning a lot about some of the conflicts that are happening over there, I just became really fascinated with this idea of becoming a peace builder. And becoming a peace builder where you stand, wherever you are, whether that's in your family, in your friend, and among your peers, in your local community, and most importantly with yourself, just being a peace builder wherever you stand. And that is making a difference. It doesn't have to be this giant, big thing. I mean, maybe one day you will travel to so many different countries, or maybe you're gonna become president, or maybe you're never gonna leave your hometown. But it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, because if you can just be a peace builder where you stand and you're making a difference and trying to lead in whatever social circles you exist, then you don't have to wait for some big event or title or accolade or opportunity to feel like, oh, this is where I'm making a difference or being successful. Like, you can find success and beauty and peace just wherever you are. And that's just something I'm really trying to focus on now, because I think I get so caught up in living in the future and being like, oh, well, when I get to this point in my life, then I'll know I've made it. Like, then I know my like impact is lasting or whatever. But I can just like do that now. And it gives me so much peace. And something else I also wanted to kind of touch on is this idea of progress and growing. And it sounds super cliche, but every day I'm just like, I'm trying my best and that's enough. I have a mentor who really had to help me kind of break down some perfectionistic tendencies in myself. And he's just like, Genevieve, like, if you're just trying to grow, then you're doing great. And I was like, oh, you're right. Like, even on the days where I'm like, I said the wrong thing, or I didn't get the grade I want, or I lost out on an opportunity. Well, it feels like I lost out on an opportunity. But if I'm just simply getting back up and trying and just focusing on like that peacemaking and peace building, and I'm growing, then that's success. And you never know what's around the corner and what's coming next. Like, life is constantly changing. And so you have to kind of just keep focusing on yourself and the difference you can make where you are, and focus on just growing. Even when it feels like you're falling short, you're still growing if you're getting up and trying your best. And that sounds pretty successful to me.
Going off of what Jenny said, I have like 2 points when it comes to success that I think of. And the first one is just, I just like really believe that there's enough space in this world for everyone to flourish with their individual strengths and to find their own like niche in this world and how they can contribute. So I think a big part of success is like finding your own strengths and developing them, and figuring out like what you can do with your strengths to help others. And I think it's just really important to remember that we all have different starting points, and to just try to not compare ourselves. I think we all have different barriers in life, and giving our 100% can look very different from someone else. And I think a lot of success is just kind of who you become, what Jenny was saying, like less so than a final destination for me. And the second part, I think, for success and how I view it is our relationships in life. I think it's really important that what we're doing is also helping other people and like strengthening our relationships, whether that's like with our family or with our friends or our community. I think I feel successful when I know that like I am loved, other people feel loved by me, and that like really I'm there for other people. And I feel like, I just feel like relationships in life are sometimes like forgotten when it comes to thinking about success. But no matter like how much money you have or position you have, if you don't have those like strong and meaningful relationships, you're just never going to feel fulfilled in life. And so I think it's just those two things for me, like finding your strengths and figuring out how you can best use your strengths to contribute to your community. And then also making sure that those relationships in life are really where they should be.
Okay, you guys are the coolest. I love both of those. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today. It's been really fun to talk with you guys and learn a little bit more with you.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. Be a friend and tell a friend about Measuring Success Right.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review, or online at marriottstudentreview.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect official policy or position of Brigham Young University or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.